I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. Gregory Thornton became CEO of Baltimore Public Schools in July. He joins us to talk about his first 6 months on the job, running a school system that he says is on the threshold of greatness, with 85,000 students, a $1.3 billion budget, and an ambitious 10-year, $980 million modernization plan. The plan calls for renovating numerous schools and closing those with declining enrollments. The school board will vote tomorrow on the proposed consolidation. Six schools would close as a result. Plus, Baltimore students take dozens of standardized tests each year. Does testing provide valuable data, or does it waste precious class time? Gregory Thornton, chief of the Baltimore schools, on Midday after the news. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us and making Midday part of your day. Joining me in Studio A is the Baltimore City Public Schools CEO, Gregory Thornton. He joined the school system in July, and we finally got him on the show here with us about 6 months into his job. Nice to have you on the show, Dr. Thornton.
It's great to be here. Thanks for allowing me to talk a little bit about the schools.
You came in from Milwaukee. You were the superintendent there for 4 years, I think.
A little more than 4 years and a few months.
Yeah. And then you had some experience in Maryland prior to coming to Baltimore. Not back to Baltimore, but you had worked as an educator in Maryland.
Certainly, I actually cut my teeth in, here in Maryland on the Eastern Shore. I actually grew up on my grandparents' farm over in Talbot County, and my first teaching job was right there in Talbot County Public Schools. I was a math teacher. And from there, I became principal. And at one point in time, I said wanted to spread my wings a little bit and left Maryland, and now I'm back home.
Did you work in Montgomery County for a
time?
I did.
I had a great opportunity in working in MCPS. I had a great mentor, Dr. Jerry Weiss, a great community to work in. We did some great things, and I was actually deputy superintendent there for a few years.
What would you say about your first almost 6 months on the job here? What has this been like for you?
It's been exciting. It's everything I expected, probably a little more. I've had opportunity in the first 6 months to talk to a number of certainly community members and a number of folk that I think have a major vested interest in seeing the city move forward. So it's been exciting.
We have a mayor. You work for Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake. She has a pledge, or anyway, she has a goal of attracting 10,000 new families to Baltimore by the end of the decade. It's something she said a couple of years ago when she was inaugurated a few years ago.
Yeah.
And, you know, everyone turns to the schools and say, yeah, you got to improve the schools if you want families to stay here.
Well, it's a number of things, and I think schools play a key part in that, and I certainly agree that it can certainly be done. You know, Baltimore's changed over the years. You know, we had at one point in time close to 200,000 children in the city, and now we're at 85,000. As you move through the city, I understand there's about 20,000 homes, and at one time those homes were filled. So it's certainly not just schools. It's certainly an opportunity to look at a holistically approach to how we reinvent Baltimore, and I'm certainly on board with her vision and hopefully will contribute greatly to getting a group of CEOs to see that this is a great place for folks to live and grow up, in a place where they can certainly bring their folks in and have quality schools. If I was a person moving in the corporate world, I would be looking at is schools. And so we got to do some work. We got some work to do.
And there's a big project ahead for the school system that you come here at a pretty exciting time, really. It's an ambitious 10-year plan, $980 million investment in modernizing the schools. That includes building some new schools, renovating existing ones, and actually closing some. I noted in the introduction to this hour that the school board will be voting on a consolidation plan late afternoon tomorrow. But anyway, of course, you knew all about this when you arrived here.
I did.
And one question I have about this, well, I have several questions about it, but one is there any concern about the funding for this project, that $980 million Baltimore can count on that over the next 10 years, you think?
I think they certainly can. I think there's a number of people.
Because the state plays a part in this.
State plays a part, city plays a part, and city schools play a part. But I think it's money that we can bet on. It's our responsibility, certainly, to get a good return on the investment of all those counterparts, of those constituencies. A number of people have put a tremendous amount of energy in to make certain this happens, everything from ACLU to build certainly to the all the consortias throughout the city.
Your predecessor.
My predecessor, mm-hmm. I think, was a champion with this particular work. And now the rubber meets the road. We got to build some schools. We got to fix some schools. And we're well overdue. If you look at the stock in the state of Maryland, you know, we have probably the oldest facilities. And now we need to make an investment. And we haven't made that investment over the years. Our schools need help. We have not supported them. We have not funded them with respect to repairs and keeping them up to date so our kids have really great learning environments.
Gregory Thornton is with us for this hour of the show, the CEO of the Baltimore Public Schools, 410-662-8780. Mm-hmm. Open phone lines for the entire hour if you have a question for the school CEO, Gregory Thornton. Now, there's some news from your press office today, quoting some report from the Maryland State Department of Education about high school graduation rates, about dropout rates, and about achievement of students on the high school assessments, the SATs, and advanced placements. So I wanted to go through this.
Sure.
This press release that just arrived a couple hours ago and go over this news with you, and I had some questions about it.
Yeah.
One thing being reported here is that students from the class of 2013, that's last year's graduating class, they entered ninth grade in the fall of 2009. 73.5% had graduated 5 years later from the time they entered in the fall of 2009, and that's an improvement of 1.8%, an improvement of 6.8% since 2010, when it says Maryland adopted a five-year cohort. Would you mind just explaining the five-year cohort for us?
When probably you and I went to school, I think we were probably in that same vintage there,
it
was only four-year cohorts. And what we're finding nationally is that many of our youngsters require 5 years. So we're beginning to elongate that cohort to 5 years. And what we're seeing from 2010 on, that we're seeing incremental growth, which is statistically significant, that our kids are certainly showing improvement. They're sticking. You know, most kids, a lot of kids around the country, and especially in rural and sometimes suburban environments, that four years is appropriate. However, what I'm seeing in a lot of urban settings that our kids just need that additional year. And what we're doing now is tracking that cohort data from that 5 year period. And we're seeing statistically differences and certainly improvements. So that's a good thing. That says that we're on the right track. We're moving in the right direction. Now, is it fast enough? The answer is no. I mean, when you go back and look at our 4 year cohort data, we're still in the high 60s. But at the end of the day, for me, it's completion. You know, so everybody doesn't get to the finish line at the same time. So we got some kids that are getting there, but they're getting there, and that's the important thing. So that's a really great, strong thing to build on as we move forward.
Did you track it the same way in Milwaukee, five-year cohorts?
I certainly did, yeah, okay. And we do it in Philadelphia, and it's done in most urban settings.
Okay.
We don't stand up well when you look at the four-year cohort data. I mean, we're in the 60s. We probably trend anywhere between 20 and 25% below some of our counterparts in around the country. But when you begin to look at five, you can begin to see that our kids just had the tenacity to actually stay and the perseverance and the grit to get there.
At the same time, according to MSDE numbers, the dropouts have fallen, nearly halved actually, declining from 1,530 students mm-hmm. in the class of 2010 to 726 students in the class of 2013.
That's great. I mean, the reality is that, you know, we're not losing them along the way. I mean, for our kids to actually have the perseverance to continue, and whether they continue with us or continue somewhere else, they're staying engaged. And at the end of the day, what we all know is that there's not a really great life if you can't check that box on an application for a job, college graduate. I mean, excuse me, high school graduate. Well, soon it'll be college graduate.
Yeah,
I got to say this. It's going to be college. But you got to check that box.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, I think our kids are realized. I think our families are realized. And I think they're getting that type of external support and the internal support to actually get them to great places. So that's a good news. That's really great news.
Let's talk about the HSA, the high school assessments, and the other testing data that came out today, if you don't mind.
Sure.
So I'll just read what's reported here in the press release, and you can comment on it. Let's see. The percentage of 12th grade students fulfilling the HSA requirements, that again is the high school assessments,
correct,
by passing all HSAs remained essentially flat from the prior year at about 46%. The number fulfilling requirements by completing this other program, the Bridge Plan,
correct,
it's an alternate program, let's see, that increased by 4.5 percentage points. So... not great news there when it comes to the HSA.
Yeah, yeah.
But an alternative that is in place for these students as a means for meeting the same requirements,
same,
right,
correct.
For graduation?
Correct.
Okay. Not much to say there. That's
not much
virtually
to say,
flat.
But flat, but as you look at the state, I mean, one important thing, we always trained ourselves against the state. We benchmark against the state. We benchmark with other school districts. And what we see, our numbers are stronger. We're actually showing growth where many other potential entities are moving in the wrong direction. So this is a really great thing. What the world's in this, well, I'll say the world, America's in this issue around certainly high standards and high expectations. And Common Core has certainly played a major part. As we make the transition, I think you're going to see a little slippage and a little flatness until we actually get on the new platform.
If this is flat, why are you saying we're showing growth against the rest of the state?
Well, I compare with the others, if the rest of the state is trending downward and we're staying flat, then I think we're encouraged.
You mean on the HSA?
Correct.
Okay. High school seniors' mean scores on the SAT, this is Baltimore City again.
Correct.
Increased slightly or were flat over the prior year, but remained more than 100 points below state and national means for each of the three components of the SAT.
Well, same thing. You know, as you look and unpack the data, you will see that the state kind of slipped back a little bit. We actually made a little growth. But the thing that's most exciting about that is that we have more kids taking it. At one point in time, the only certain kids who were college bound were heading and taking the SATs. And now I'm pleased to say that we've widened the door, because what we're saying is that every kid, given the opportunity, can certainly go to college. So you may not go when you're 18. You may not go when you're 19. You may go when you're 25. So we're really pushing and opening the door as wide as we can so our kids get an opportunity to be exposed. So I think we actually grew about 9% of the kids moving forward and actually taking
and thinking
it,
about college.
And thinking about college, taking right. the exams, and certainly positioning themselves to move forward.
You know, I remember when this we had a news story in The Sun, I don't know, sometime within the last month or 6 weeks, about the SAT scores falling statewide or in the region anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons cited was the one that you just cited. And I thought, well, you know, why are kids taking the SATs if they have no intention of going to college? Well, that's sort of the wrong way to look at it, isn't it? Because you're opening the door, you're getting them thinking about college. Even, I mean, I hate the SATs too, but a kid can come away from it feeling kind of defeated too, couldn't they? Isn't that the downside of it?
Most definitely. But what we need to do is certainly create the rigor so they don't come away feeling disenfranchised from being able to go to college. See, I believe all kids can go. I just believe given the right conditions and the right supports, all kids can make it. I believe that's true here in Baltimore City. And exposure means everything. I mean, if you're not exposed to something, certainly you're not going to certainly engage in it as you move forward. So I think the strategy that we're using here in the city is really appropriate in getting kids to be exposed and then providing the support systems for them to be successful.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to go back and say, this thing has changed with a whole issue of transitioning out of high school into the world of work and the college. And kids go out and they do different things. They explore the world. And then 3 years later, they say, I want to go to college. And certainly we've created the readiness and skills that are necessary for them to be successful, to be in place. The SATs are just one indicator. They're multiple measures. And as we continue to move forward, what we want to do is certainly identify what those measures are and certainly utilize those things as ways in which we get kids further engage.
And if they don't do so well the first time on the SAT,
do it again.
Do it again. Show some grit.
You show
we
some
did
grit.
A show, we did a show last week on grit
in
education. Yeah, I'm sure you've heard that buzzword in education.
I do. A good colleague of mine, Angela Duckworth, is out of University
That's
of Pennsylvania.
That's why we were talking about it.
Yeah. Well, Angela was here. I didn't know
well,
that.
Well, no, we used her TED Talk to launch our discussion of it.
Right. Yeah. Well, I will tell you, children in the city have a lot of it. And this is where you want to find grit, you find it in cities like Baltimore. Our kids go through a lot of trauma and challenge and in a community that's certainly really challenged. And as a result, I see kids getting up every morning. I see attendance starting to move in the right direction, not as fast as I would want. You know, I can't say any of these things are happening as fast as I want. You know, I would love to sit here and say we had 90% graduation rates. SAT was at the state average. But the fact that they have that tenacity to actually continue to persevere, that's grit to me. That's something deep down inside that's hard to give people. Some people feel they can teach it. I don't know. I think it's partly taught and partly something in your genes that get you there.
One last thing about this before we take our first break, and we'll come back and take some calls for Dr. Thornton. Baltimore's the school district's results on advanced placement exams. Yeah. Here's some interesting information here. There's some gains there. 9% more students taking exams, AP exams, and 4.5% more exams passed in the past year, in 2013 versus 2014.
Well, I think that's very encouraging because the AP program out of College Board is one that's given around the country. And now the benchmark is not Maryland. It's the whole United States and probably the world where everywhere they utilize College Board products. And this says to me, again, more children are being exposed. More children are actually meeting the expectations. And what this says to me that these youngsters now are positioned to actually get college credit when they go in with the passing scores. So it becomes an economic factor for a parent. You know, if I was a parent, take every AP test you can take. That's going to help me with respect to minimizing my financial impact. But again, it certainly shows an increase in exposure. And those are things that we want to do for our kids. For a very long time, there are certain children didn't get access to these exams. I'm pleased to say that the city has done it. And we will see numbers there go up and continue to go up. Now, I will manage some expectations. The more kids you have going originally, then you're going to see a flat line of the results.
Mm-hmm. Gregory Thornton is our guest, the CEO of the Baltimore City Schools. He's been in that position since July. It's our first visit with him on Midday. You're welcome to call in, ask a question of the school CEO, Gregory Thornton, 410-662-8780. We can take questions by email, too. That address is midday@wypr.org. And also, we're on Twitter at MiddayWYPR. You can send a question in that way. (410) 662-8780 is the phone number for Midday. Live talk here, Dan Rodericks, with Baltimore City Public Schools CEO Gregory Thornton. We were just talking about some test results, SATs, the HSAs, advanced placement tests. So that question about testing, I'm sure you get this all the time because we've had a couple of shows on this just in the last few weeks where people call in and seem to be concerned that there's so much emphasis on testing. Students and teachers spend so much time preparing for these various tests. And some people scratch their heads over this. And then others say, well, this, how are you going to measure progress? You know, we had No Child Left Behind and then Race to the Top. We have all these strategies. But, you know, how else do you measure if not by testing? How do you evaluate teachers if not based on the test results of their students? This is complicated.
Sure.
So I'll give you a chance to talk about it.
Well, let me share a couple things. One, I believe testing is just one vehicle. There should be multiple measures in which we assess our teachers, we assess our children. And I would certainly agree with the community who says that we do too much of it. High-stakes testing is one that has shown us to change very little outcomes. I mean, where we actually make tremendous strides in formative assessments, two types of tests, formative and summative. Formative. Formatives are basically what you use to improve instruction. And teachers should be always formatively assessing young people, where they're going, where they need to go, what kind of conditions they need to create in classrooms, what they need to teach, what they need to teach more of, what they need to reteach. It's very, very important. Some of it's changed very, very little. Those are typically done for external audiences to judge where a system is.
You just like us.
Like the SATs you just
like
asked me about.
Right. Yeah, okay.
I mean, that's one point in time. But I really believe that there's so many other indicators that we can take a look at that are key performance indicators as to how children are doing. Are the kids coming to school? Take a look at attendance. Take a look at what kids do on a daily basis. Take a look at the portfolio. Take a look at samples of their work. Those are real strong indicators. But I do believe in the world that we live in, there are ways, and you have to have ways in which you sort. And we sort kids by summative assessments, and they're high stakes. And as a result of that, I mean, some of our kids just don't do well. And because of that, I think you see people pushing back. But there's never enough of formative assessment.
I was just going to ask you, we emphasize one over the other, right?
We're emphasizing the wrong one. We should be working on ways and how we can certainly get our kids to learn and learn deeper learning and certainly be able to analyze and be critical thinkers and things of that nature. That's what teaching and learning is about.
Speaking of testing, Julia, one of our listeners, has a question for Gregory Thornton, Dr. Thornton. Julia, go right ahead. Welcome to the show.
Yes, I just heard in the last week on the radio that that the there was a seventh grader who could only read at a first grade level. Is this the result of No Child Left Behind? This kid was just passed so that he would stay in the same grade as his peers?
Julia, excuse me, was this in Baltimore?
I'm not sure where it was. It was just on, I think it was on one of the programs over the weekend that they were talking about it.
Well, this is a question that comes up, and Julia frames it in, you know, No Child Left Behind, which now we're moved on to Race to the Top. Anyway, that idea that students are pushed along when they're not ready to be, advanced through grades, I don't know.
Well, one is not race. Certainly it's not No Child Left Behind, but I think our point's well taken. And one of the challenges has been is that we have not made the appropriate accommodations for learning early on. And as a result, sometimes youngsters are moved forward. We actually use summer experiences. We use extra time. But I would suggest that a youngster who's in the seventh grade, who's functioning on the first grade level, there's some deeper challenges that we would want to explore as a system to find out what are the barriers in the way of the youngster learning. Mm. What we've also found is that keeping kids back doesn't do it. And what you're seeing across the country is that I move away from that. When I was a little guy going, if you didn't pass third grade, guess what? You stayed
behind.
Third grade.
Yeah, right.
You could be 25 in third grade. That's an exaggeration. But at the end of the day, what we found, it didn't change the outcome of the discipline and the understanding of the learning. And now what we're seeing is accommodations made by teachers and looking at interventions and supports. That's what does it. So as we move forward, I don't think there's anyone to blame here. Certainly No Child Left Behind, but I think good quality teachers know what to do. They go, they probe, they find out where the challenge is, then they remediate the challenge, and then they reinforce the challenge. Those are the kinds of things that happen, and they can happen on grade level by differentiating the experience for kids in the classroom. You get a classroom of 30, 25 kids, they're all at different levels.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end, that's exciting, that's the cool stuff. But at the end of the day, great teachers make great things happen, and they create special learning opportunities for all of them.
This system that you've come into to run, does it have in place the personnel, the infrastructure to handle students like that, to intervene, to say, yeah, well, there's a problem outside of the school. There's we need a social worker here. We need some kind of intervention. We need maybe law enforcement Do we have that kind of...
Yes and no. We need more. And in our community, certainly our children are in need of a number of supports, both in school as well as out of school. So as we continue to move forward, we're challenged. One of the big challenges we have internally is staffing. I opened the school year this year with 150 vacancies. That's unheard of. Which is
150 teaching
vacancies, which I'm down from prior years. You know, the reality is right now that we can't produce enough, we haven't produced enough classroom teachers in the state of Maryland that's actually moving into K-12 urban environments that are prepared to come to Baltimore with a desire to come to Baltimore. So we use a number of sources.
It's not because those positions aren't funded.
Oh, no, they're funded.
They're just vacancies.
They're just vacancy, pure vacancies. And as a result of that,
how are you getting by with missing 150?
Well, if you break it out to 177 schools, that's less than one person a school. And
okay,
you want a quality teacher in every classroom every day, pushing kids to places they wouldn't normally go. So that's a challenge for us. So as you ask the question, do we have the resources we need? Certainly we need more. And certainly we need to certainly place the people that we have funding for. So we're working with our higher education partners now. We have a wonderful, rich number of college partners here in the area. We've sat down together, and we're trying to figure out ways in which that won't happen again. It's been happening in Baltimore for some years now.
I thought we had a good contract in place with incentives and merit awards for teachers.
Yeah,
what do you think of the teacher contract here?
It's exciting. It's really, truly exciting. And I think the folks who have really benefited most have been certainly our teachers. I think they're engaged in really looking at ways in which they can hone in on their craft. They're taking additional units to prepare themselves to certainly teach at high levels. However, it has not been enough to attract people.
Under the opposite impression, so
not
I'm glad you're here to tell
not
me
at
this.
Not at all. We've had some human capital challenges. We have a number of principals have turned over. I think the number is somewhere between 100 150 and 180 over the last
principals
over the last 5 to 6 years. Those are big numbers. So those are the things that we need to stabilize. We got to be certain that we attract good people, we retain good people, we train good people. Those are the things that make a difference in classrooms.
Gregory Thornton, the CEO of the Baltimore Schools, is with us to answer your questions. 410-662-8780 again is our phone number here. Himani, I hope I pronounced your name correctly, in Federal Hill. Hello?
Yes.
Hi.
Oh.
Go right ahead.
Good
morning. You're on the air.
Okay. I'm a resident of Baltimore City, and we just made a transition from a private school to a public school environment for our first grade son.
Great.
And I would say that the school that we're sending our son to is an example of a real success story. I mean, I live in a neighborhood where families routinely make the change and move if and when their kids get to an elementary school age. We have a new principal in our school. We have a very active PTO and really just great problem solving in terms of keeping it a good community school where we can get good quality education with great teachers. But I wanted Dr. Thornton to comment on the funding line and how it gets decided. I'm a new parent in a new public school. And what was explained to me was that, you know, enrollment starts in the fall, in September, and then somehow the city comes in October and recalculates the budget for schools based on your enrollment as of October 1st. So the school year is, you know, underway. Teachers are there. Their salaries are identified. The budget for supplies and other activities has been established. And then on October 1st, there's some kind of recalculation. And what happened to our school was that we kind of overprojected and our budget was underfunded October 1st. It was a little bit outrageous that, you know, we're sort of in a mode to go. September 1st, we're planning, and that things need to be recalculated. And our school is a little bit smaller than some of the other, you know, elementary schools. And so when the budget gets shifted, I think it disproportionately affects a small school because a few students who may have moved or transferred or whatever, it could mean a salary line for a teacher.
Himani, I have a question for you before Dr. Thornton responds. So I just want to understand, when you say our budget was underfunded, did you mean that as of October 1st, you didn't get the per student funding you were expecting to get? Or the overall budget was lower based on the enrollment?
I think I know exactly
what she's talking about.
You understand why I'm asking? I didn't quite understand what she meant.
What happens is we make projections, and that's how we allocate money. And the projection that was made on her particular school and several other schools is that they thought they would get more children, so they got more money than what they were actually deserving with respect to per student amount appropriation. And this is when I have to step in and basically do things such as really take a deep look into your school to be certain that that adjustment does not modify or does not hurt the instructional program. And that school, I remember, we did do that. We actually provided additional dollars there to certainly sustain the program that's going on. You know, I think a lot about this, and this is one that's not just in your school but throughout the system. And when do you calibrate it? You know, there's some school districts that are playing with calibrating it at mid-year, but what you try to do is minimize the disruption early, later in the school year, and do it early in the school year. So there is certainly some theory of action potentially around a calibration that potentially could happen mid-year.
Well, Himani, what was the consequence in your school? I mean, what was missing there because of this?
I mean, Dr. Thornton's exactly right. We had a number of parents who went to City Hall and stated the case, and you know, again, Baltimore City is one of those cities where there are lots of choices in terms of public, charter, private. And for parents who want to keep their kids in a good community public school, in the end, they reallocated some money. So we had some, I can't remember, if you have a certain number of children who are getting free lunch, or there's like a financial stuff. We had some money that was then emergently put in to the budget to make sure that we didn't lose some of our special programming.
Oh, a special program. Okay. That's what I was getting at. I was wondering, you know, what was the consequence of this? And doesn't the per student amount remain the same?
The per student amount remains the same. However, when less students there, certainly you don't need that student amount. So what we did, we went in and...
No. If the per student amount is a per student amount.
Correct.
Versus the overall, the total of the budget. I understand
correct.
That. So if you have 35 students and you were expecting 40, you don't have as much total money, but doesn't the per student amount stay the same?
The per student amount does stay the same.
Okay. So it's commensurate with the number of students
correct.
In the school.
Correct. However, from a programmatic design, sometimes you're not able to provide the program. That's where I have to step in and become a support system for the school to ensure that the program may go on. You may lose enough that you don't have a teacher.
Yeah.
And so if in the event that happens, then I need to intercede and basically provide a differential mm-hmm. that allows that to happen. And I do understand. The challenge is that someone picked up more students. So as a result of that.
At another school.
So we got to go on the other side and certainly create the adjustment over there as well.
By the way, I noticed a number here, 81,000 and 85,000, that 4 years ago, the enrollment was about 81,000.
Correct.
We've moved up closer to 85,000 now.
Correct.
Which means the city is growing, or that more parents are opting to leave students in public schools or put them in public schools. Like Hamani, she made that choice to go from private to public.
Sure. And I think that certainly speaks to the support and the investment in public education in America. And I think there's some great things going on. We have some great schools. And I think parents are really becoming great consumers of education.
Yeah.
And as a result of that, they were at
Hamani sounds like
one. There was a school fair last week, and mm-hmm. The place was full of hundreds of parents, and they were taking a look at all the options, and folks are beginning to see that there are great opportunities that sit right in their city schools, and they're choosing. And you will continue to see that move. As the school district continues to improve, so will the investment on the part of our community members. And if you were to ask me 5 years from now, I would say that number should be right around 90,000. We will see steady growth.
Gregory Thornton is our guest in this hour of midday, the CEO of the Baltimore Schools. We'll take another short break here and come back and take some more questions for him. If you have one, 410-662-8780. Few areas of the country have as many historically significant sites as the Mid-Atlantic region. Coming up in midday's second hour, travel writer Charles Mitchell offers suggestions for trips to historic sites in Maryland, Pennsylvania, and Virginia, many of which are decked out for visitors during the holiday season. Travels with Charles Mitchell when midday continues after the news at 1. A question for Gregory Thornton from Wayne, one of our listeners here on the Midday Show. Does he support the Ingenuity Project? We are considering moving our son from a well-known boys' independent school for the Ingenuity Project. I know someone who did exactly that.
Great.
But are concerned about continued support from North Avenue.
Well, I would say sign him up. I actually met with the folks from Ingenuity yesterday to talk about the future of the Ingenuity Program. And what they can anticipate next year would be certainly no change, but we will actually launch a group of folks to sit down and talk about the future Ingenuity and how we can expand. We need to have a strong, strong program for some of our very, very achieving youngsters and very, very gifted youngsters. And what I've seen preliminarily is that Ingenuity is a great, great program. I actually had the IB program and Ingenuity at the same table yesterday talking about the future. They were worried last year. They're worried this year because last year actually there was a cut. We actually restored the board, came back in and restored it after it was cut. There's no plans to change the Ingenuity program nor the IB. It is a plan to take a really deep look at, you know,
excuse
ways.
Me, when you refer to IB,
International Baccalaureate.
Oh, thank you.
International Baccalaureate.
And there's four schools for the Ingenuity Project.
Correct.
Roland Park, Hamilton, Mount Royal, and of course Poly.
Poly, correct.
Right.
The high school program, and they actually feed up into that. The Poly program, as well as IB. There's a middle years IB program that certainly feeds into the certainly city program. And certainly there are great programs around the country. There are primary years IB I mean, there's things that I like about both of them. I'm really getting to understand the Ingenuity program. One thing I really, really enjoy about the IB program is it requires all kids to take two languages. And I think it's important in the world today, with the world changing so quickly, that every kid's bilingual.
Could you comment on the modernization plan? We touched on it earlier.
Oh, yeah.
$980 million,
sure.
A 10-year plan. It seems like there's been an announced revision to it.
Yeah.
So fewer schools are going to be affected. Some people are wondering, why is it 28 schools, not 34?
Sure.
Why are you closing this nice little elementary school that's serving a good population in Waverly? What's going on? So,
well, let's unpack it one by one.
All right.
When actually the money was appropriated, there were certainly big goals and big dreams, and we always want to do more than we're able to do. I heard numbers as high as 50. I heard numbers
for
from
number
30,
of schools.
Yeah, number of schools. I heard from 30 to 35. I heard them drop to 19. But as we began to go into it deeper, going to architectural reviews, submitting the architectural drawings out, it really appears that the number is going to be somewhere between 23 and 28. And hopefully, based on where the market is, what we borrow the money for, certainly will have a tremendous amount of impact on that.
The 23 to 28 represents schools that would be renovated?
Renovated, what we would call renovated or replaced.
Okay.
And sometimes those replacements are just as costly as a new school. And a lot of times we made decisions to actually go on and certainly replace because the structural changes needed were just not enough for a renovation.
If the board approves this consolidation plan,
correct,
tomorrow there would be six schools closed.
Correct.
Are those six schools being closed simply because of declining enrollment or because of physical structure as well?
It's everything, you know, and let me go back and say that's a hard decision, probably the hardest decision any board can make around closing schools, because at the end of the day, schools are it in many communities like ours. Everything else is gone. You know, certainly businesses have left and schools become the hallmark of the community. So we looked at multiple measures as we began to make a decision as to what we would certainly close. But it wasn't about closing, to be very honest with you. It was around what are the places in which we can go in and make a difference and create better opportunities for kids. And, you know, the one that constantly gets a lot of conversations is Abiston. Abiston Elementary is a wonderful little school. I had an opportunity to visit. We have a utilization challenge there. And enrollment continues to decline. Last year there was a bump up, but at the end of the day.
Excuse me, what did you mean, utilization challenge?
Utilization meaning.
Too big?
Facility, correct. I mean, when I went to Abiston the other day, there were certainly four or five rooms that we just were not using. We have another school there that wants to grow. And then we're looking at opportunity and access for the kids at Abiston. And we have a wonderful Waverly project that's exciting. It's advanced academics where kids will have an opportunity to participate and come from all over the city. And in this particular case, we have an opportunity not only to have that great project at Waverly, but we also have enough room that we can certainly meet our utilization targets that the youngsters from Abiston can actually take part of into it. So it's not just around facilities and size. It's everything. Can we create better opportunities for young people? And in doing that, we certainly want to be good stewards of taxpayers' dollars. We want to utilize facilities in the right way, and we want to leverage those resources, certainly to position us for more students coming. Those 90,000 I told you about, they're coming.
Mm-hmm. You heard him, folks. He projected 90,000 students.
In 5 years.
You're at about 84 now.
I'm at 84.
All right. Okay. 5 years, huh?
Okay.
Let's take another call for Gregory Thornton, the CEO of the Baltimore Schools. Kevin, in Baltimore, you're up next. Go right ahead, please. Hi.
Hi. I'm calling about specifically students that don't necessarily test well in standardized testing, but yet are, you know, in performance situations, can perform well. Like, for example, if you had a test that somebody actually had to sit down and take as opposed to doing an oral examination, some people work. People respond differently. How do you deal with those kinds of situations where somebody might not be great on a standardized test, but outside of that, they could, you know, show you something that would wow you?
Well, I certainly agree. It goes and speaks well to my whole ideology around multiple measures. You just can't measure it in one way. And I'm so glad HSA has figured that out. There's a traditional HSA, and then there's an alternative, which gives us a number of ways actually to assess whether a youngster knows the skills. There are many ways. Certainly there's a portfolio, there's oral presentations, there are many ways, and you're absolutely correct. I mean, our kids are wonderful. They have many styles of learning, and they also have many ways in which they can demonstrate their learning.
Is that what the bridge plan is?
It's a bridge plan.
So that offers them an alternative. It's not just an easier test?
Not by no means.
Because some people look at that
and say, it's harder.
That means it's an easier test than the HSA.
Yeah.
But it's not?
No.
It measures other things.
It measures the same things in different ways. I think it's even more difficult. And what I find is that kids are able to be successful and proficient at that bridge program where they're not in traditional things. So the caller is absolutely right. I think there's gone are the days where there's one way and only one way to assess whether young people know things.
Hey, you know, you mentioned the 150 teaching vacancies you had this year.
You looking for a job?
Well, I wonder, what would you say to a 21 or 22-year-old man or woman about teaching in the Baltimore City schools or teaching in general? What would be in 2014 going into 2015, which is quite a different time than when you started as a teacher?
Oh, gosh.
What would you say to them?
One, I would extend an invitation. If they are truly invested in the future of our city, truly invested in children, I can't think of a better place to actually launch a career. Gone are the days.
What if they're not invested in that yet? How would you pitch that to them?
I would get them in classrooms. I would get them visiting schools, and so they can catch the bug. They can get the fever. Because what I know is that most folks want to give back and make a contribution. I can't think of a better contribution than actually going in classrooms, whether they spend 2 years, whether they spend 5 years. We have great alternative programs that allow our teaching profession to actually transition in, transition out. Certainly our Urban Teachers Initiative, I Teach for America. I think it's a wonderful way to certainly make a major contribution to our city and to our children and families.
Why don't more people go into it?
Well, less people are going into the profession across the country. At one point in time, I mean, that was the place you went. I mean, and unfortunately it was...
Well, at one point in time...
For young ladies especially.
It was a place where you went where you didn't know what else to do with your life. That was the rap on teaching. And there wasn't enough emphasis on professionalism, that this is a career.
And it's a wonderful career. But I will say as I move forward that the career that I knew of when my second grade teacher announced her retirement after 45 years, those folks don't exist. But there's still a group of people that are so committed and so invested, they want to spend their entire life dedicating themselves to making communities better. But what I would say and what we've done is we've segmented it. We have some folks that come in and spend 2 or 3 years, and they make a major contribution. And for that major contribution, we get a major return on investment with children. There are people who want to spend 5 to 7 years. There are people that actually...
I mean, they don't want to devote their whole life to it.
They don't want to do it their whole life, but maybe they just want to start there, and they really want to do another aspect of education. And we have wonderful support systems, whether it's administration. You know, we have 11,000 employees over there, and there's certainly job opportunities there.
I don't think we praise teachers enough. I don't think we make them heroes enough in this country. I'm talking about the country in general.
They're heroes in my mind.
I know they
make magic happen every day with sometimes really challenging young people with challenging life experiences.
Let's go to Richard in Baltimore and take his question. Thanks for calling Midday.
Hi, Superintendent, how are you? I'm from Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Hey.
Hello.
And I'm one of your biggest fans. I was the executive, or still am the executive pastor at Holy Redeemer.
Oh, my goodness.
We were your largest voucher school and quasi-relationship school with public schools. So we in Milwaukee are angry with Baltimore for stealing a great superintendent.
Well, Richard, are you in Baltimore or are you in Milwaukee now?
I am in Baltimore.
Oh.
I'm born and raised in Baltimore, still have family in Baltimore. I'm here until December the 26th. I go to and fro for a sick route. So this is...
he's visiting.
That's all right.
Okay.
Hey, brother, it's
I'm
good to hear you,
visiting, but I still have my Baltimore pass.
Well, it's good to hear you. And thank you for being a part of mine, man. You made life there great. I appreciate all of you.
Well, let me tell you what my comment is. In Baltimore, how do you intend to navigate between the parallels, which you didn't have in our city, what you have here? You were great at making things work. Where a voucher school did better in one area, you as the public school superintendent fought for us, and where it didn't work, you gave us a whole lot of hell. The difference is, in Baltimore, you have an extremely controlling union. It's a one-paper town, usually, under the thumb of the union. How are you going to broker that and make vouchers work and unions less obstructive like you did at home?
Well, my goal is to make life better for kids. That's what it's about. And I think if I stay focused on children, I think the community wins, I think kids win, and I think we all understand it. And what we got to in Milwaukee was around winning for kids, winning for our communities. And at the end of the day, it didn't matter where we stood, whether we were vouchers, whether we were charters, or whether we were traditional schools. Because at the end of the day, a kid really doesn't care. And a parent really doesn't care. They just want to know their kid has a quality education, they can go to college, they can get a job. And, man, I appreciate all the support you guys provided me in Milwaukee. God bless you.
You saw the results of the survey that was taken by the Fund for Educational Excellence in Baltimore. It was pretty interesting. One thing I wanted to note to you and get your comment on, since Richard brought up charter schools, residents said they want consistently good schools across the city so that parents feel secure, that they can send their children to those schools and aren't caught in a last-minute scramble to get their children into the top-tier charter schools. The Baltimore Sun notes in reporting on this survey, the Montessori Public Charter School, for instance, has about 1,000 children on its waiting list. So, I mean, I know that's a tall order, but people want to know you can send a kid to just about any school in Baltimore City and have some confidence in it.
We have a great slogan that sits on all our schools, great kids, great schools. And some of our let me acknowledge all our kids are great. A few, a little challenging on some days, as you would imagine, but we don't have great schools throughout the city. We have some great schools, and I got to be certain that they all become great schools. No matter where you end up, no matter what your zip code is, no matter whether you have access to transportation, you can have a great school in your community. So as we move forward, I got to build the schools that the community wants. That's how you engage. If I'm going to get the 90,000 people here, I got to create ways in which I'm giving parents the schools that they need and they want and they expect for their children, and not the ones that I want to deliver. So when you talk about Montessori, I'm pleased to say that, you know, I'm looking back, and we had the largest public education Montessori footprint in America in Milwaukee, because that's what our community wanted, and our community engaged. We had one of the strongest arts. Certainly support systems, and we got to begin to build where folk are. So what will happen later in the spring, we'll have a major initiative trying to talk with parents around where do they want their schools to be, where do they want what their schools
to look
like.
You mean as part of the modernization plan?
As part of the modernization, mm-hmm. because the modernization gives us an opportunity to leverage those resources to build the future. It's about building on our future.
You said in an interview with the City Paper a couple of months ago that you felt that the schools were on, or that the city and the schools was on the threshold of greatness.
You know,
I mean, that's an optimistic thing to say. It gets
it
everybody
is.
Feeling good, but I want to know why you feel that way.
You know, it takes collective will to do anything. And when I think and have conversations, certainly with the governor who's actually leaving, certainly the mayor. Certainly all our higher education partners to our foundations. You know, I mean, I have strong support from the Weinberg Foundation, certainly Casey Foundation, and the list to Open Society. And everybody seems to be focused around making life better. You know, our city.
For those kids.
For the kids. But it's not just making it better for
the
kids.
You mean for the city in general?
For the city. But people are beginning to realize there's a high correlation between how kids do and how this city does. So as we continue to move forward, I'm seeing the stars starting to align now. Do we have the courage? Do we have the will? That's going to be the big answer. Mm-hmm. And do we have the money? I mean, and, you know, I believe the skill is here. Now, the question as a community, I don't know if there's a will to begin to do things differently to get us to where we need to go. There's enough examples that we can point to around America where we have really transform school districts, and you know, and I believe we can be one. So when I look at that whole list of individuals that are committed to the city being a better place, I'm encouraged.
Hey, we're short of time, Dr. Thornton, but one of our listeners wrote in wondering about parent involvement and what your observations are so far about that. Are you getting into are you seeing some crowded hallways with volunteer parents in Baltimore?
You know, and really at the early at their early stages, and when you get into some of our schools, and which is great, it creates my
you mean elementary
school. Elementary school. Yeah. It creates that pipeline to the 90,000 that I'm certainly talking about. But we got to certainly get parents to continue to be involved. And involvement means a number of different things and different things at different grades. So as we move on into higher and high school is exposure, and certainly we're trying to reach out. You know, we're tweeting, we're Facebooking, we're doing all those kinds of things to certainly keep folks engaged.
Gregory Thornton, it was a pleasure to meet you and have you on the show. This is a good start that I hope will be a number of conversations with you on Midday. So
I would
come back
so.
And visit us.
It's been a pleasure. Look forward to coming back again.
Thank you.
Have a great holiday.
Happy holidays to you, too.
As well.
Gregory
Bye-bye.
Thornton, the CEO of the Baltimore City Public Schools, has been our guest for the first hour of Midday. Another hour of Midday coming up after the news from NPR and after we take a break to sample lunch from the Bagby Pizza Company, located in the historic Bagby Building near Harbor East. The Bagby Pizza Company offers brick oven, thin crust pizza, sandwiches, pastas, salads that are made fresh daily. Bagby Pizza is open daily, 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. Delivery is available nightly, 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. We'll see you for the second hour soon.